Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I'm afraid that I'm scared now. What? I am so scared what you say. Thank you. Anyway, thank you very much for the invitation, Adrien and Fred and David. The other David. There are many Davids. Okay, so what I'm going to, so this is the title, yeah, Selective Persistent States in Balanced Networks. It's going to tell you about some work that we did in the last 3-4 years, which is still in progress. There are new directions that we have started in the, even the last year. But I will start from very, very old stuff, something that you certainly know, and which is the fact that neurons in vivo are temporally irregular in their firing patterns. Now, this is very old stuff. This has attracted the interest of theoreticians for many years. This is an example from experiment adapted from Shadland and Newson 1998. This was an experiment where the famous random dot experiment with a monkey seeing a screen, facing a screen with input, visual input, and random dots going on the screen, and a recording made in MT. And this is a raster of the activity of, I think this is essentially one neuron recorded many, many times upon presentation, many presentations of the many trials. And what you see in this some structure, bands here of, and you can see also this on this plot here, which is, so these bands, I mean, this very, very precise band, this is related to the structure of the stimulus. Okay, so there is some regularity or irregularity, which is, but which comes every time at the same time. Now, between these bands, you see, I mean, here, these are highlighted here. So actually, your firing rate can remain more or less constant, is what is shown here. And here there is no, the spike trains are very, very regular. And what's plot here is the interspike interval, the histogram of the interspike interval of the neuron. And what you see that it's exponentially distributed with here a refractory period. Okay. Now, if you plot the variance over the mean count, so, I mean, it's something which is the variance is in the order of the mean count. Maybe it's a, but I mean, all this is an example showing that this variability of the irregular spike trains in vivo. Now, there is a recent study which, okay, first of all, yeah, before that, so this is something that you know. Certainly, the measure of discharge variability, the CV, there are many other ways to characterize it, which is the variance, the standard deviation over the mean, and these are two extreme cases, periodic. And irregular, so for periodic, CV equal to zero, irregular, CV is positive, and Poisson gives CV equal to 1. The CV equal to 1 doesn't mean necessarily Poisson, of course, but so in general, 2-1 is our reference to say if there is a lot of variability in spike trend or not. Now, there is a recent study, is you see, Shinomoto and 20 other people, so it's so this is what David was saying the other day, high energy physics paper. And what they did here, they gathered data from many situation cortex and many different areas, M1, SMA, FMD, SCF, I mean, here, prefrontal and visual cortex. And they have a measure of variability, which is not exactly the CV, but which is same spirit, I mean, the variation on the always on the same team. And this is to show that actually there is quite a lot of dispersion. I mean, the regularity, the degree of regularity of the spike trends is not everywhere the same order. But what is very interesting for us here is that in visual and prefrontal cortex is quite high. I mean, this is actually where the irregularity of the spike trends is. Okay? So it's a very interesting study here. I mean, it's very difficult what they did, they really put together data from in many different situations. So I think that was in case it was they put also the delay activity. We'll come back to the delay activity topic of the talk later. Also, I mean, many situations in order just to have a very rough impression or rough characterization, let's say, of this diversity of, yeah. I mean, in general, the idea is that these primary motor areas, so they must be more less variable, people would say, in order to be more precise or more. This is my, I mean, I don't have really an intuition. I mean, if it is closer to something which is the output, so there's an idea. Yeah. There is another study actually which shows it changes when you are closer to some, when you start to do something in the motor cortex. Yeah. So say. Yeah. No, no, this is, first of all, it's not me. Okay, this is, I'm not among the AL. But no, so this is what I said. So they took all the data they had. I mean, really, if you look, I spoke actually with Shinomoto. What? Yeah, absolutely. So, no, but here they are mixing recordings during behaving with recordings during spontaneous. With different all kind of stimuli, so I mean it's I should have also mentioned this. Yeah, no, I mean it's something, some very global. but I think it's interesting. I think it's really a very interesting and important paper. Delay activity of prefrontal cortex neurons is highly regular. So I already mentioned this on the basis of this Shinomoto et al. Study. Here, this was quantified in specific conditions, and we come back later. This is actually the main topic of the talk. We'll be doing this. So what Albert did here, and he knows much better than me all the details, he studied the irregularity and the patterns of firing of the neurons in oculomotor delay tasks. So we had the data, many neurons, compared and measured the CV and the histogram of the CV and many other things. But here, this is the histogram of the CV in the prestimulus period and during the delay period. And the idea here, the conclusion here, is that you see that the I would put it like this, the irregularity of the neurons, of the spike trends of the neurons during the delay is at least as large as the irregularity of the neurons during the prestimulus. Do you agree with this statement like this? So it's a conservative statement, not saying it's more, I'm saying it's at least as large, okay? And this is, so you can compare this, here's the histograms. This is really wrong one, this is a bit shifted. Can discuss the issue of the statistical issues here, but I mean, I think this is the claim. The claim is delay activity is at least as irregular as the activity prestimulus. I'm not saying spontaneous, because prestimulus is something which happens there, fixation, but this is as a statement. Yeah. No, in prefrontal cortex, you mean from the previous, you have here, this is 1.3, 1.2. No, it's not the CV, some variation of the CV. Let's take it as a CV. Okay. It's a. Okay, now another feature another feature is heterogeneity in firing racing cortex. So there are some papers recently which claimed that it's a log normal distribution. If you look at the distribution of the spontaneous firing rate here in cortex, this is in auditory cortex, adapted by a paper of Homatka and three other people, I think, four other people. So this is the histogram, and this is the log of the probability density the probability density of the log, and you see that here you have something which is looks like Gaussian, and this the claim was, okay, so it's log normal, and that this, I mean, the claim also was actually in this paper that, and a fourth paper which came right after that, that it's, there is a big, I mean, it's not clear how to get log normal distribution in cortex. This was a claim, okay, and that they had the whole story I will comment about it in some moment. Okay, so irregularity heterogeneity. Now, this is an issue. This is an issue, and actually this is an issue which for theoreticians, not for experimentalists. For experimentalists, I think they would say, okay, it's noise, there is noise because there is noise. And that's okay. I mean, there is noise, everything is noisy. Reality is noisy, the world is noisy, you go in the streets, noisy, so there is noise everywhere. So it's normal that in the brain there is noise. Now, on the theoretical point of view, it's not that clear. It's not that obvious. And there are many works on this topic, actually. 1992, 1993, Softy and Koch, with Chaim, this was one of my first paper on the field, was about the issue of how to get this irregular firing of neurons, Shadlan Newsom, von der Weide, Sapolinsky, and this we'll talk about a lot about these two papers. I think actually it should be 96 and 98, not 95, 96, in the talk, Tsarik and Sezhnovsky and many others. And actually, I think that the problem was raised even well before, and the late Mandelbrot, I think 1964, already had a paper on that issue to try to explain why neurons are irregular in vivo. So, I mean, okay, fundamental issue, but why? So this is something that, which is very basic. So you forgive me if you know already this, and I'm sure that most of you know already this argument, why there is a problem. First of all, a single neuron is not stochastic in the following sense. If you take a single neuron in a slice, you inject a step of current, so the neuron fire essentially periodically or very small variability, CV 0.1, 0.2 maybe. So at the beginning you have maybe, this is a case of a pyramidal cell, some adaptation, and then periodic firing, but essentially the activity is very periodic. Okay, so then you have noise. Of course, if you inject noise, the neurons are becoming noisy. Okay, so if you inject noise, it's obvious. I mean, you inject noise, and noise in the current, you take the step, you make noise on it, and then neurons start to be very irregular. Okay, this is fine. But now the question is, yeah. Which accumulate. Yeah, this. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, absolutely. It accumulates. You need to accumulate a lot. Yeah. So. Yeah. No. This. Yeah. And I think there. I mean, they were showing that you accumulate. It accumulates. So if you look at the 100 milliseconds or 200 milliseconds, it's not. It's very regular. Okay. So now let me go over the argument fast because I mean this is something which is well known and. So the point is that now in cortex, so the cortex is noisy. Yes, you say that the cortex is noisy, so neurons receiving noisy input because noise is there. Okay, but now one cell, postsynaptic cell, receives in principle. I mean, the idea is that it receives from many. I mean, there is a recurrency which is quite large, so it receives from many. Many means more than 30, let's say. Okay, so in fact, it's even much, much more than that. So there are C presynaptic afferents which are also noisy. Now the mean. So if J is the strength of the synapse, if C now is the number of synapses, and U, let's say, an estimate of the firing rate of the neuron, so the time average of the input is say G nu. Now the fluctuation is the variance is say CJ squared times nu, and now the ratio is 1 over square root of C. So of course, all what I'm saying here is that there is the central limit theorem says that the fluctuation compared to the mean scales like 1 over square root of C, like 1 over the number, square root of the number of the presynaptic neurons. Okay, so this is a cartoon just to show this effect. So you go from C equal to 1,000 to C equal to 5,000. So you have a reduction of the fluctuations compared to the mean. So what that means, that until now, so neurons essentially, so if you assume that you have noisy brain, so the neurons are noisy, so in this with this argument, and this was our argument which raised all the problem, so you would say that essentially neurons should be driven by the mean and not by the fluctuations. The fluctuations, the input would be small, and compared to the mean, and the mean will drive them. And if the mean drives them, so we are back, like in the situation of in vitro situation, in the slice, and where there is a constant input plus some small noise on top of it, and the output, the neuron at the output should not be. Will not be variable. So now there will be no. So there will be no noise in the system. So there's a problem of consistency. Okay. So this was the issue. This was why so many people were thinking that there is a problem here. Now, of course, in all these arguments I said, so there was I made an implicit assumption that there is an excitation. Okay. I did not consider the inhibition, and this was the big idea, that actually what will solve the problem is by taking also into account inhibition. And this is a series of two papers, a short paper by von Breeswijk and Sampolinski, which is about 1.5 pages in Science, and the long paper, 98, which is, I think, a factor of 100, yeah? 100 pages. It depends on I hope. Ah, okay. Yeah. So essentially the idea goes as follows. So this is a model. You have N E and N I neurons. So N E for excitatory, N I for inhibitory. N E and N I are very large numbers, a lot of neurons. And they are connected at random without any particular pattern of connectivity. C input in average, so now the connectivity is random, so the number can fluctuate from one neuron to the other, the total number of inputs can fluctuate. In average, are C input, and this is the ordering. One is much smaller than C, much smaller than N. And connections here are strong. So what does that mean, connections are strong? It means that in terms of scaling, how it scales with the number, the average number of connection, it scales like 1 over square root of C, and not like 1 over C, okay? Like there is two ways to scale here, just kind of the mean field standard way, which is 1 over C in order to keep, I mean, you have 1 over C for the strengths, and you sum C inputs. And the other way here, this is the scaling which is important here, it's 1 over square root of C. And if you do this, then what happens? For the average excitatory input, so you have C multiplied by order 1 over square root of C, which means order square root of C. For the average inhibitory input, you have minus C, now it says minus because it's inhibition, multiplied by order 1 over square root of C. So this is minus order square root of C. So both now, if C is large, both excitation and the inhibition are large. And now, to keep, the system must keep its activity at a normal level. I mean, the brain should be in a state which is, I mean, normal. Normal means not going to epilepsy or exploding, that the activity would not be too large. And on the other hand, the activity will not go to zero, so that the excitation will not go over the inhibition, and that the inhibition will not go over the excitation. So you need a balance, and the name balance excitation of inhibition. So this is a very precise, I would say, physico-mathematical meaning of the balance, which says that the time, I mean, the mean input, the time average input that a neuron receives excitatory and the inhibitory cancel each other at the leading order square root of C. Okay? So to keep the activity finite, the two inputs should cancel each other at the order square root of C. Yes?
Yeah, but the
Absolutely. But here, I mean, it means the idea is that you it's very large. Yeah, it's much larger than the threshold, much lower. Yeah. Yeah. So threshold is one. Okay. Okay. Now, if you look at the fluctuations, so for the fluctuations, so this is a bit different. So first of all, because I mean, the fluctuations of the excitatory input in the excitatory input, now compared to the excitatory input, are very small, but the order one. Okay, it's square root of c divided by square root of c, so it's order one. Okay, for the inhibition, the same, it's order one. Now fluctuations, you have to sum up them. Okay, so now the total fluctuations are order one. The threshold is one. Okay, so the fluctuations are so okay. So fluctuations are order one. At the leading order, the total input is not square root of c, but it's order one. And the threshold is one. So now we have everything at the same order. So the activity can be irregular, driven by the fluctuations. Okay. So this is the idea. So this is what is shown here. So taken from the paper, the don't remember if it's small or the long. So the excitation, excitatory inputs, the inhibition, and the total which fluctuates, and the threshold, we see it's one. It's here. And occasionally, a spike is driven. So this comes from a simulation of intermittent fire that so we pay attention to the CV and another measure of variability, CV2, take only the CV here. Essentially, the same. The two histograms are the same. So this is the histogram of the CVs, and in a simulation, intermittent fire simulation, with the prescription of the balance state, and you see that indeed CV is around one. Okay. Now I would like to formalize this a bit more, and to and this will be very important for the rest of the continuation of the talk. So this is the balance condition of the leading order. So again, the excitatory population, the inhibitory population, and this is the time average input mu e mu I, and I mean that which is all the square root of c, and with all the contributions, the recurrent excitation, inhibition to excitatory population, Ix, which is some external background input, and similar formula for mu I, and this is, this should be sigma actually, I don't know what is s. For the fluctuation. Now, what is important here is that when you write this, when you formalize this, what you get in here, what is nu e and nu I, this is a population average activity of the excitatory population. Okay, so balance here means that since mu e and mu I at the leading order should be zero, so it means, should vanish at the leading order, so it means that we must have these two equations. These two equations, which are determining the population average activity of the excitatory and the inhibitory populations. Okay. And what you see here, that at this level, for the if you are interested in nu e and nu I, so the nonlinearities of the neurons are gone. Okay. So you can compute. I mean, you have a very simple system of equations, which simply says that you have the balance, which fully determines nu e and nu I. Okay, GE times nu e, this is the excitatory current, and GEI times nu I, this is the inhibitory current, and the minus sign here, on the excitatory population. Okay, yeah. No, see, no. You can also, if you increase the strength, I mean, it goes together. I mean, you can all. Yeah, it should scale like one. You can change G, I mean, the strengths. Okay. Okay. So this is the idea. So it's very, very general. So two equations which are linear. Now, this is at the leading order, but in fact, I mean, and this about the population average. Now, what happens at the level of the neurons? For single neuron. Okay, so here, there are two things. So I already mentioned the fact that spiking is temporally irregular because the activity will be driven by this noise. And also, I mean, everything is the same order. So now that means that if you look at the effective input-output transfer function of a neuron in the network, if you start, I mean, let's start from some if there is no noise, so you would get an FI curve which is like this. So this would be the case of the mean driven without fluctuations, okay? And if you add the noise, so you get this kind of this shape, okay? And this shape actually, what we showed with Carl, and also there are some experimental works on that, you can very well approximate in presence of noise. You can very well approximate this input-output transfer function in some range by power law. Okay, so this gives some idea of what is the shape there. Okay, now the between the two, here there is no noise in the external input to the neuron. So you take, I mean, this is you can think of this first of all outside of the network. Okay, you take the neuron, inject current. If there is no noise in the current, typically what you get as a firing rate as a function of the total mean current, which increase like above threshold. This is a threshold, that is a threshold. If the current is above threshold, this is without the, this is single neuron. We are back, I mean, here I'm plotting the single neuron. Now, in the network, if I'm looking at the neuron renormalized, let's put it like this, by the network, so what is this transfer function? It would be like this. Because now there is noise from the network, and at the end, you need to close the cell consistency. Okay, but this is just to explain why, in a very natural way, in the balanced state, you will get a distribution of firing rates of single neurons, which will be almost log normal. We don't need any fancy story about the connections and very, very natural universal. And the idea is this, I mean, essentially this, that the input-output transfer function is like this. Now, if you look at what is the input, now what I said is that at the leading order, the input is zero. At the order square root of C, the input is zero. But now there is a residual. So how the residual is distributed? The residual is distributed according to a Gaussian distribution in the network. Okay, if I'm going from one neuron to the other, so there is a quench disorder in the residual input current that the neuron is receiving. The term which is order one and not order square root of C, because the order square root of C, this is common to all the neurons. And this cancels, so there is some residual. And this will be Gaussian distributed. And now if you take this input, you feed it into the FI curve, you get, because of this acceleration, you get this skewed distribution. And what you can do even better than that. You can use the idea that this is a power law and show that actually in some, don't think that the exponent will be very large, 3-4 is enough, in order to have a very, I mean, a distribution in general, which is very well approximated by a log normal distribution. Yeah. Yeah, so here I'm assuming that all the connections have the same strengths, and I'm assuming that the number is fluctuating from one neuron to the other.
Okay.
That it's
but
it's.
I guess the picture would change if you
use the number. Yeah. Carl wants to say something that I. Yeah, so this is. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, should I mention? Yeah. 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 Yeah, absolutely. So the idea here is that same way as within the balance. So you, after balancing the square root of C in the temporal fluctuations, so you are up, now we have fluctuation for the one. So you have the same argument now for the quench fluctuations. For the quench fluctuations, so what you remain with order one fluctuations in the quenched, for this non-leading order term in the. So this is from a simulation that we did recently with Alex Roxin and Carl also. So here this is an integrated fire showing in an approximate balanced state. I mean, in reality, you are never in the strictly speaking, mathematically speaking, balanced state because C is always finite, okay? But C is large, one much smaller than C, much smaller than N. This is the mean input, the Gaussian distribution. This is a distribution, so one, we pick up in the network 150 neurons to have same statistics as in Chromatka. what we did here, we plot the distribution of the log nu. So these are the data, I mean, these points here, this is a simulation, and this is a fit to a log normal. Okay, so actually, so this is, will be pretty good. It's not, I mean, you have some deviations here. I mean, but it's not very essential. I mean, the whole idea is that expansive nonlinearity with a power law will give it to you. And since the power law is a very good approximation, and it's also related to this Gaussian distribution, so you don't need anything special for that. Okay. Yes. Yeah, I mean, if you look at the data, yeah, it's yeah, but I mean, there is nothing odd in the log normal. It's, I mean, it's log normal because alpha is, I mean, the exponent of the power is sufficiently large, 3, 4, and that's it. It's not okay. Okay. So to summarize here, so what are the signature of binary states in that you would expect? Now, if the synapses, we know they are mediated by conductances, so high conductance. Large level of synaptic activity, fluctuations, strong fluctuation is a membrane potential. This is because there are some lot of fluctuation presynaptic input. You will have irregular spiking, which is driven by fluctuation and by mean synaptic input. Heterogeneity, as I said. And this is one important point. Until now, what I've shown, the way I presented the balanced state. So what you will have the single neuron nonlinearities wash out effectively at the level of population activity. Okay, you can determine the firing rate of the population, and then from this, you deduce how strong is the variability and how diverse is it is the firing rate of the across neurons. Okay, so for population, so I mean, it's uniquely determined by a set of two equations which are linear. So it's very universal, okay, which is very nice, but maybe it's too universal, which can be bad, okay? And the reason that it is, I mean, too universal is this linearity. Okay, we have these two equations, which are linear, and at the level of population, what a network which is linear at level of population can do maybe many things, but it can also, there are also many things that it cannot do, okay? If the computation is driven by population, so, it's a strong limitation. And actually, this is what the topic of the talk, I would say, and it has to do with the issue of delay activity. How can we understand now what this observation, this result, that the activity during delay in this working memory experiment, the activity during the delays is as irregular, at least as irregular as doing during the fixation or prestimulus, or let's call this roughly spontaneous activity. Okay? And I will explain why. Okay, so but first of all, I would like to describe the experiment now that of a specific delayed response task, and this is oculomotor delay response. The monkey is facing a screen. There is a fixation point. There is a prestimulus period of 1 second. There are four possible positions in this case where Q can appear. Q appears for 500 milliseconds, some position. The monkey has to remember where the Q was for, let's say, 3 seconds or maybe more. And after the 3 seconds, the monkey has to do saccade. There is a go signal, the fixation disappears, fixation point disappears, there is a go signal. And it should go in the direction where the Q was. I mean, the saccade should be in the direction where the Q was, and then it's rewarded. Okay. So this is, and then after that, one records, when we look at the recordings, during all these different epochs, and this is data from Funahashi and collaborators. So this one was Shintaro Funahashi was in the lab of Pat Goldman-Rakish. After 6 years of preparing the experiment and recordings, they published the paper in 1999. It's a very difficult experiment. Shintaro told me once that when he arrived there in the lab, it was for his postdoc. So Pat Goldman-Rakish asked him, so are you patient? So he said, yes. So then she said, I have an experiment for you. And then so he started to do this training of the monkey. I mean, you can imagine what that means. And then recordings, and I saw the experiment now, the way he's doing after so many years of that he's experimented in that. In Kyoto, he's doing this, continuing to this kind of experiment is terrible. I mean, the good days, there is half of a neuron. So, and they record during, I mean, for students and postdocs. So this is a recording from one neuron. So during, so the Q was here at 180 degrees. And so during this pre-stimulus, the Q, some elevation, and then the activity remains. So this is what I call the delay activity, remains at some more or less stationary level until the time to do the saccade is arrives, and then there's a saccade and some kind of reset to, let's say, baseline. Okay? Now the same neuron, but for a Q at 0 degree, so will respond differently. Okay, so this is during the delay here, there is suppression of activity instead of increasing the activity. So here the delay activity is maybe inhibitory, even less activity than during the pre-stimulus. Okay, so we have here two aspects, persistence of activity and selectivity. So selectivity here is summarized here now in this more recent paper. There were here eight directions. And so you plot, or they plot, a tuning curve to describe the tuning, so exactly very similar to what is done in V1, so to describe the selectivity of the response of the neuron. And this is a typical best tuning curve. I mean, when you look at the data, it's, of course, much more, much less nice. But it, I mean, this is a very good example of selective response of the delay activity. And now, so again, just to remind you, so this is what I call the delay and the pre-stimulus, and the histograms are of the CV around one. So again, high variability in both epochs of the experiment. Now, there is also diversity. Actually, the tuning curves are rather very diverse. So you can have sharp, you can have broad. You can have tuning curves which are really you have less than spontaneous in cross direction, and tuning curves which are overall raised and broader. I mean, there is a lot of diversity in the shapes. Okay, so now I would like to address first of all the issue of persistence, and so explain why we have the problem of accounting for the persistent irregular firing. So, I mean, the classical mechanism, and this is something which is well known, this is come back to Ebb, the classical idea of how to get persistent activity. So you can take the simplest network you can imagine, simplest network, one population of excitatory neurons, even forget about inhibition, and you write a mean field model of this, J is the strength of this recurrent excitation, nu the activity of the neuron, Ix the background input, and phi the input-output transfer function of the neuron. And what you need in order to get, to explain this persistence, you need a transduction function which is sigmoidal. You write this equation in a graphical way, and it's clear what happens. So you have the intersection of this function phi, nu equal to phi of phi, and this straight line, and you see clearly that if j is too large, you have only one state which will be here. So which means that all the neurons are at very near saturation, and if j is small, you have only one state, which is a very low rate, and in between, and you need to tune quite a lot, so you will have three states, two stable, one at low rate, one at high rate, and in between an unstable state. Okay, so this is a classical. You can generalize all the, I mean, you, so this is, this network will be persistent in the sense that you have two states which coexist in the same situation, let's say spontaneous one and a persistent one. Okay, now obviously here, you need a nonlinearity. Okay, you need a nonlinearity at the level here phi, you can think of the transfer function of single neuron, or you can think of it as a transfer function of a population of neurons. But you need a nonlinearity. Okay, it's a macroscopic, we have here a macroscopic phenomenon. It's a population which sustains its own activity, and we need this nonlinearity. Now, we know that in balance, if we want to extend the balance scenario to explain this, the variability also in the persistent state, so we would need two states which would coexist, which are balanced. And this cannot be. This cannot be because we are linear equations. Okay. So this is the basic, I mean, why we have a problem. Now the question is how to solve this problem. And actually it's miserably trivial. Although there are many, many papers. I mean, there are several papers who try to find some solutions, but actually it's miserably trivial, I would say. It's embarrassing. So why it was linear, and this I hidden it. I mean, I did not mention this earlier, because, I mean, we assume that the transmission is linear, interaction are linear. Why it is linear? Because the transmission is linear. But in fact, I mean, the equations, the linearity here is because the currents depend linearly on the presynaptic firing rate, and because they combine linearly. So the idea is that actually, maybe, if you have nonlinearities, now, in the interactions, and not only in the single neurons, okay, so maybe then it will work. So this equation that will become nonlinear in some sense will be, I mean, it will be much more, I mean, and also conditions, the balance condition, let's say, let's put it like this, the balance condition at the leading order will now become nonlinear equations, depending on some variables, maybe not only on the activity of the neuron, but also on many other things, fluctuation, etc. But these now will have, as a leading order, what will determine the population activity. So the macroscopic activity will be nonlinear equations. Yeah. So in the balance, unless the intrinsic currents are on the same order of the synaptic currents, so they are not entering into the balance condition. Okay. So that, I mean, that's a, this is, but this raises, I mean, many questions. And these are the questions. Yeah. I'm sorry. No, so. Yeah. As Carl said again yesterday when we were working on the beach, the problem with the balance state is that we have to be very careful with intuition. So, no, so it goes the other way around. The balance condition determines the population average firing rate in very general way. Okay, like this. Nu is a population average activity. Oh, this is external input, yes. Mu, external input. Yeah, I should have mentioned that external input is also of the same order. Yeah. But this determines the population. Once you know the population, then you go to the next order. And this will determine the single neuron firing rate and also the fluctuations. I mean, and then you have to solve. It's no. This is no. I. Yeah. So for the population.
So it's intersection, but the point was, so the solutions
are
intersection.
For
the.
Yeah.
But you just told us.
Yeah.
That actually, because of this cancellation, there would be no
finding
was
a fluctuation. No. Yeah. But the fluctuation will be determined by these values, okay? I mean, this is what is very nice in this balance. I mean, this is, and then I mean, with this you have all kind of non-intuitive effects, which yeah. Yes. The fluctuation of order one, the intrinsic properties are coming back. Yeah, the intrinsic properties of the neurons are coming back at the level for the single neurons, but not for the population. So this can affect the statistics, maybe. But yeah, I mean, a very small number of neurons. Okay, we can talk about it later. Yeah, I mean, it's much more than 10, especially in the tuning curves they are born. This was one of the solutions that was. Sorry? Yeah, but no, okay, so this is another story. Yeah. Okay, this is amazingly simple answer, but now actually there are some questions which are coming with this. And which is now what are the appropriate synaptic nonlinearities that you would need for base stability? In which synapses you will need these nonlinearities? You want to have a justification of these nonlinearities, so to have some biophysical substrates for the nonlinearity. And this is until now only base stability. Now, of course, now for a persistent for the selectivity, you also need nonlinearities. Are these nonlinearities compatible with the persistence? Should you add other kind of nonlinearities together? I mean, many different nonlinearities together. And of course, also the issue, and this I don't mention here in this list, there is the issue of, I mean, if you write the equations now, so it's become much more, I mean, the balance equation becomes much more actually complicated, and self-consistency becomes now much more complicated. I mean, it's not only, I mean, we have some nonlinear, some linear equations when the transmission is linear. If the interactions are nonlinear, yeah, there's a lot of problems of exchanging nonlinearity and averaging. So we know that where we put the, how you average, I mean, averaging a nonlinear term is something which can be highly non-trivial. And this is for analytical calculations and but I'm not going to address analytical issues here. Only very, very trivial point I will mention now. Okay, so what are the appropriate synaptic nonlinearities for base stability and in which synapses? So it turns out that, so what we do in the very naive way, okay, and I'm not here, I'm not addressing the issue of this averaging that I just mentioned, how to average nonlinear term. What I'm doing in a very naive way, I'm just replacing JEE nu e by JEE nu e times a function of nu e. Okay, so this is the synaptic current, and in the recurrent excitation, I assume that it is like this. And I think I will not have time to go into the details. I have half an hour. Oh, yeah. So I will not have time to explain why. I mean, here also you can do a calculation which is in very few lines. And to show that actually what will do the job is if you assume that this function FEE has this shape, okay, increase and decrease, okay? And in such a way that nu E times FEE nu E is actually a sigmoid. And this is very simple, actually. You can take, I'm not doing the calculation on the blackboard, it will. To gain time, but you can just naively, you take this two balance equation, you replace JEE nu e by JEE nu e times FEE nu e of nu e, and everything else is linear, and you solve the two equations. And you eliminate the inhibitory activity from the second equation, you plug in the first equation, you rearrange the term, and what you finish up is actually with the equation of one population of excitatory neurons with a transfer function, which is nu e times FEE of nu e. So that's why it works. Okay. Now you can do the same thing. Actually, you can also put nonlinearity in the I to I and show that also you will get by stability. And if you put in E to I and I to E, it will not work. So in a way, this is really what you would like to have. Sorry? You mean?
That shape.
Oh, you mean the biophysical substrate?
No, no. How did you get it from the lab?
Oh, it's simply that what you need is here some saturation.
Okay.
Yeah. So it has to decay, and to if you multiply this by nu e, so it is should be like this. Yeah, it's qualitative form. Yeah. Okay. Now, actually, you can solve now these nonlinear equations. With this naive model, and this is what you find. You find so a phase diagram like this, a function background input and JE, and you have this bistable region here. Now I would like to point out to something, which that it's rather robust, and in a way it's more robust than the standard. This balance, let's say balance persistence, is more robust than the standard scenario. Why? Because in the standard scenario, you have this problem of the shape of the slope that should control. And if you multiply, for instance, all the coupling strengths by the same number, so it can affect. I mean, you will go out of this. Either you will have too much inhibition, or you will get too much excitation, and it will be very difficult to keep this bistability. Now, in this balance regime, you can multiply all the coupling strengths, coupling constant by the same number, and this actually cancel out. So there is more robustness here, and when you do more detailed models, so really spiking networks, etc., so you see this effect clearly. Okay, now what is the biophysical substrate for the nonlinearity? Yeah. Yeah. So I'm going to. No, it's not easy, but I'm going to show how. Results that you can do it, some simulations which show that it works. But, see. Okay, so biophysical substrate for the nonlinearity, I will go very fast on that. Short-term plasticity is doing the job. So, you know, you can take the Misha's model for that. And when I'm saying short-term plasticity is doing the job, I'm talking about not talking about the dynamics. I'm talking about the fact that in the short-term plasticity, if you assume facilitation and depression, so the input-output transfer function of the synapse, okay, current versus input rate, so output current versus input rate, so as precisely the shape that you want, okay, and in the standard model of Misha, it even decays like 1/m, so you have the saturation that you want. Okay. So again, so what will do the job? Now, if you want to have a biophysical substrate, take a spiking network, integrate and fire, for instance, you couple the neurons with synapses which are in which the recurrent excitation has the short-term plasticity with facilitation at low rate and depression at large rate, and it should work. And this is actually what we did. We did a simulation here. So I'm not going very fast here. So it's a network with a lot of neurons, 64,000. We did even some simulation up to 256,000. Neurons are randomly connected. These are the numbers that we put in the connectivity. We also tested with the scaling with the connectivity, which is important. I want that when we take the limit n goes to infinity, c goes to infinity, and we have the scaling 1/√c, we need to be sure that this phase diagram is not going, I mean, the region of bistability is not going to shrink. So actually, it cost me pain in the back doing this simulation last year. I did a simulation up to 256,000 neurons and taking connectivity up to 12,800. It was very long simulations. To really check to do the phase diagram. What? Yeah, I know. Faster than the brain is doing it, yes. So anyway, here are the results that I'm going to describe rapidly. So just to show, so this is a phase diagram of this integrated and fire network with short-term plasticity in the E2E. So very similar to what you have in the naive model. Low activity here, large activity, persistent activity here. And again, if you do the scaling, essentially this region remains exactly the same size. If you change the connectivity, And so it's really very robust. And this is to show, I mean, this is just a population activity. So the excitatory and the inhibitory neurons is to show that you can switch on and switch off from a low activity state, high activity state. Now, what happens in these two states? So just to show that it's indeed balanced, or approximately balanced, since C is finite here. It's not, well, not in the mathematical limit where the balance state is strictly defined. So this is to show that we have this balance. So this is a neuron, which and the input to the neuron, so the excitation, the inhibition, and the total. Okay? And this is during baseline, this is during delay. And this is the temporal time average. So what I did here, I looked at all the neurons in the population, and I did the time average of the excitatory input, of the inhibitory input, and of the total input. Okay? And then I plot the histogram. And this is normalized to the threshold. So what you see that this is for the inhibition, this is for the excitation. So five times or larger than the threshold, even a bit more. And then when you sum up both, the total, in average, is below threshold. The threshold is here. This is a bar here, one. Okay? So in order to get firing, you need really the fluctuations. And see what is shown here. What I did, I plot the histogram of the average total input plus 1.5 the standard deviation of the fluctuations. And this is the green histogram. Same thing in the delay. So really what you have this as a network both in both situations, baseline and delay, is in balanced state. This is raster plots showing the irregularity of the spike trains. And this is the histogram of CV and CV2 in both situations. So here we have an increase of the CV. The histograms are shifted to the right. And this is the distribution of the firing rates. Yes? Yeah, there is more of connectivity, and also there are synapses which are slower. Yeah. Okay, now, so this is a balance of, if we want to have bistability between balanced states, so what I showed until now is that this nonlinearity, the shape of the nonlinearity in recurrent excitation will do the job, and that short-term plasticity provides the substrate for that. Short-term plasticity, I mean here, the nonlinearity under which is created by the short-term plasticity, I did not address the issue of the dynamics. The dynamics of the short-term plasticity can also be important here, but I'm not addressing here the issue. Maybe at the end, if I have 2 minutes, I will say something about that. Now, you asked the question of selectivity to have multistability. Okay. So back to the Bible. It's back to the Bible. So what is written in the Bible? In order to get selectivity, you have the ring model. Yeah, I can show you where it is. Yeah. You need some commentary, which is from the 20th century, but it's Old Testament. So this is the ring model. I presume that, I mean, at that level of the talk, I can go and assume that you know what it is. And okay, so in the ring model we have this symmetry breaking. We have the stable states of the network. It's a bump, it's not the homogeneous state. The bump can be localized everywhere because of the rotational symmetry. You select, and then you have this bump at position. And then if you look in terms of neurons, it means selectivity of the response of the neurons. If you have a weakly tuned input in some position, so some direction or some orientation, so you will get a selectivity. Okay, now, in the standard model, there is no persistence, which means that if you take out the, the input, the external input, so the system goes back to zero activity. Okay, so you cannot persist, there is no persistence. Now the question is how to get the persistence. So, I mean, there is a paper, very interesting paper, again by Albert, 2000 of extending the ring bond. It's a simulation paper where they build a ring model where you have persistent activity which is selective, coexisting with an homogeneous state, which is correspond to the baseline to spontaneous. Now it turns out, so when we are doing this this research of the balance persistent selective state, so we thought, okay, so probably it's very simple to get it in standard model. It turns out that actually there are several ways, several scenarios to several mechanisms to get selective selective persistent non-balance. And again, it has to do with non-linearities in the input-output transfer function of the neuron, what is the shape, and one possibility. So this is one possible mechanism that you can think of, and it is the following, and I'm not sure that, and I think that this is not actually what happened in the simulation of Albert, but this is just to show this relationship between single neuron non-linearities and selective persistent non-balanced activity. So you take a single ring network, say sigmoidal non-linear neuronal transfer function, and you assume that the gain of the this transfer function at low rate is smaller than at high rate. You assume that you have sufficiently but not too strong homogeneous excitation, which means that the J0 part of the interaction, the homogeneous part of the interaction, is large enough to have coexistence of two states with homogeneous low and elevated activity state. So here, essentially, the idea is that if you take out the J1, if you take out the modulation, forget about the modulation, so you will have, because of the sigmoidal transfer function, you can have two states which are homogeneous. But now, if you take into account the modulation of the interaction, so the idea is that because you have the gain at low and at high rate are different, so you will have a Turing instability only in the up state. Okay, so again, the network is bistable if you forget the modulation. If you take the modulation to zero, now you turn on the modulation, and the first homogeneous state to be destabilized by Turing instability will be the up state and not the down state. So this is one possibility. This is not the only one. Okay, but again, this is to stress. This really rely on the single neuron transfer function. Action? J, so think of you have J0 plus J1 cosine theta. Okay? So for in the homogeneous state, the contribution of J1 cosine theta, this is does not contribute. Okay? So for the homogeneous, you can have two states if J0 sufficiently excitatory. Okay. So this is one this is not what he has, because in this case, actually the J0 is negative. So you cannot have bistability of the two states, two homogeneous states. It's dominated by inhibition. So then the question is how to do it with the dominated by inhibition. There's whole story. It's not, yeah. So single neuron was bistable. Okay, so I will come to this at the very, very end. Okay. Okay, so this is just what I just said. That's it. Okay, so this is just for what? In the model of Albert, which again probably is different. The non-linearities which are there in the input-output transfer function of single neurons are of a different sort. So this is taken from his simulations, just to show. So here, spontaneous state, then there is a cue, then there is a bump, and the bump will stay where it was initiated by the cue. Okay, the cue has disappeared here, but the bump was created and stays there. Up to some drift, which is interesting for Ila and Joram was talking about this drift yesterday. So there are some fluctuations, and then there is something which happens here: external input which comes in and switch off back to was, and this is a tuning curve during the delay. Now, I don't know from where I took the numbers. Is that right? Yeah, OK. So maybe ask you something. So here, in this simulation, so there is external noise. So neurons are not really, I mean, there is local noise from outside. So neurons are firing to some extent with irregularity. But during the fixation period, so there is this pre-stimulus, CV is 0.7, and during the delay is 0.3. So there is a substantial reduction in the CV. And the reason is, I mean, simple. It's because here in this network, there is no balance. So everything is driven by the mean input. The firing of the neurons is not driven by the fluctuations. OK. So the issue was, I mean, again, I mean, this is a macroscopic, this is a collective phenomenon. So we are facing exactly the same problem as in our bistable problem earlier. Now we have also the question of selectivity, how to get also the selectivity and the persistent, and which kind of nonlinearity will do the job in the interactions now. And it turns out, I think there is more work to understand why it works, because the very simple arguments that I was making for the bistability does not hold now in the case of selectivity. But it turns out that if you use exactly the same nonlinearity as before, as for the bistability, which means a transfer function now of the synapses, which has this shape, so like, for instance, with short-term plasticity, so it works if you put this nonlinearity in the recurrent excitation. And I'm going to show the result of the simulations. On this, we don't have full understanding of whether this is sufficient or whether this is necessary and sufficient. So I'm going just to show the result of simulations here. So what we did, we built a network of integrated firing neurons, a ring model. What?
It is sufficient for sure.
No, sufficient. No, I say it's sufficient. Yeah. I'm not sure whether it's necessary and sufficient. Yeah. For sure. I mean, you did not see the result yet.
Right.
So maybe it's not sufficient. OK. So we have. So this is a ring model. So made of integrated firing neurons and in the E2E. We have this short-term plasticity. What I should say here, so there are three kinds of inputs that we are going to use. There is a background, which is constant in time. There is a transient input, which will represent the cue, which will be tuned. And transient lasts, let's say, 300, 500 milliseconds. And then there is another input, which is the input, a transient input, which will come at the end of the delay period to erase the memory. OK, so this is the I arrays. And so this is result of simulation. So what you see here, you see so spontaneous Q, a bump, which is formed at the location which is given by the Q, so direction of the Q. And when the Q disappears, the bump persists. And then there is a reset with a transient input at the end. Now if you look, if you plot the average firing rate of the neurons during the delay as a function of theta, so what you find something which actually is very disorganized in a way. I mean, it's not, you don't have a nice line. You have a lot of diversity, OK? It's already indicating that we have this diversity, again, like in the balanced state, yes? At the simple balanced state, yeah, for heterogeneities. And I will show more about this diversity. I mean, it's. So there is a lot. This is really a specificity of this simulation. You cannot find this in the standard. I mean, standard model. I think we don't see this. And this is the activity of the population activity of the excitatory. Pay attention that the firing rate actually in the delay, in average, the level of the population is not that high. I mean, it's three hertz compared to 1 hertz. Okay. This is for the excitatory neuron. For the inhibitory, it's a factor of 2 above that. And this is to show the balance. So again, so what we did here, we took the excitatory input, take one neuron, you took the excitatory input it receives, the inhibitory input it received. And for each neuron, so we do some time average, and we plot this as a function. So now this is a profile of the temporal time average of the inputs the neuron received for the inhibitory, excitatory, total threshold here, and 1.5, and mean plus 1.5 standard deviation of the fluctuations. So you see clearly this balance. So it's again normalized to threshold. This is during fixation, and this is during the delay. So during the delay, now, of course, there is a profile. Okay, there is a profile. And you have a very small here, if you look at the net, you have a small modulation. And the fluctuations also are tuned in such a way that everything, if you add fluctuation plus this residual, so you have a fluctuation-driven regime, and so the fine rate of the neurons will also be tuned. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. No. Okay. So there is a whole story here. It's very robust. You can play with inhibitory connectivity. You don't need actually, for instance, that the inhibition. I mean that the profile of the anatomic interactions of the inhibition don't need to be broader than excitation. Now, you have a lot of. Okay, so this is for those who are interested in drift of the bump. So what I'm showing here is that the position of the bump during the delay period keeps the memory of the direction of the cue, although there is some drift. So what we did here, we did several simulations where we initiate the bump at different positions. Okay, so at 3 seconds, it's at the time where the cue is presented. And what you see that we look at the angle of where the bump is, the max. So we compute the population vector. Okay, and there is some drift, but it's not that big. Over the delay here, it keeps the memory for quite a long time, although we have a lot of noise in this system, and also a lot of heterogeneities in the connections. I will say something about that at the very end. Yeah, so I just said I'm going to come back to this at the end. Yeah, but over the time of the delay, it keeps enough memory, let's say. They can compute maybe the Fisher information. But, Yeah. I think, yeah, but beyond 20 seconds, probably it's a different system, it's not the same working, it's not working memory, it's different. Yeah, I mean, there is a paper by the group of Pierrot de Cellini in France where they compared oculomotor delay task in normal and Parkinson's patients. And they saw that after 20 seconds, after 20 seconds, Parkinsonian and LC are behaving the same, and before less than 20 seconds there are differences. So probably it's different. We'll come to that at the end maybe, say something about it, about this drift. Okay, now delay activity, we saw the bump, this was at the level of the population, now we can now go to the neurons and look at the tuning curves. So what we see what we did for some neuron here, so this is a tuning curve during the delay. We are also plotting here, for comparison, the tuning curve during the queue. I mean, the queue, this is evoked activity. Okay, and during the delay, this is persistent activity. So there is a priori no reason that, I mean, they should have the same preferred direction, so they should have the same width. I mean, so that's why we are interested also in comparing the tuning during the delay and the tuning during the queue. Okay, and this shows, I mean, the PSTH, 20 trials. And here, what we show the CV, the population histogram, the interspike interval distribution, of the CV of the interspiking thermal distribution for the what we call preferred. I mean, this is again following the paper of the data analysis of Albert, what we call preferred. I mean, there is, we take all the response for when the Q was presented within some range of direction around the preferred direction of specific neuron, and we say do this for all the neurons, and we have this CV distribution, and this is for the in the non-preferred. So we see that there is some, depending on the direction, there is some difference, but not very big. I mean, in all situations, we have a lot of variability. Yeah, these are simulations. Yeah, this is simulations. Look like experiments. Yeah. Okay, now the diversity. So diversity, originally, I mean, what we discussed was the diversity in the average firing rate of the neurons in balanced state. Now we have also diversity in the tuning curves. So we are getting for the same price, the regularity in time, diversity in tuning curves. And this is to show, I mean, really six examples with very different tuning curves. Okay, so this is in this case, for instance, so again, the black is the tuning curve during delay, green tuning curves during Q. And so for instance, in this case, so both tuning curves are very similar. Both of them in cross, they are below the spontaneous level of activity. Both of them are broad. In this case, both of them are sharp. In this case, they are both above, okay? In this case, one is sharper than the other one and much lower than the other one. So there is diversity in the tuning. And actually, this is a histogram of the tuning widths, measure of the tuning widths of the tuning curves. What we did here, actually, there is some problems that we cannot, not all the neurons have their tuning curves that can be fitted with a circular Gaussian. So 50% of them can be fitted well with a circular Gaussian. And for the other 50%, we need another measure, and actually what we use, the circular variance. So this is what we show here. This is those that can be fitted, so tuning widths, if you can fit with a circular Gaussian. So for excitatory and inhibitory, the inhibitory are broader than excitatory. And this is, now if you look at the circular variance for all the neurons, putting all the neurons together. And now what we did here, we looked at the preferred direction of the neuron around the distribution of the preferred direction around a specific position on the ring. Okay, so in the classical interpretation of the ring model, there is a direct correspondence between the angle theta and the preferred direction or orientation of the neuron. So around some theta, so all the neurons will have very similar, almost the same preferred direction. And you see here that what happens, that actually here we have also diversity of the preferred direction. If you take one position, neurons around that this position on the ring can have different values of the preferred direction. Yeah. Yeah, of course. Yeah, but again, it is specific to the balance. Because it is specific, because if you have averaging of these heterogeneities, of the quotient heterogeneities, so you are losing this. So in the case of Albert, so you had random connectivity? No. But this is specific. Again, I mean, this is really specific. And now this is what we did here. We compared the tuning width during delay and tuning width during Q. And you see here some correlation is very bad. For the preferred orientation, for preferred direction during delay and preferred direction during Q, we have much more correlation. And this is from the data. Okay, so again, so in the experiment, there is much more correlation for the preferred directions than for the tuning width. So the tuning width during delay and Q means there is some lot of different, I mean, fluctuations. Yeah, so this is diversity, again, is coming from the fact that you have this randomness in the connectivity. No, the plasticity is not doing the random, is not responsible for that. The plasticity is responsible for the nonlinearity in the E to E interactions. Because of that, we can achieve multistability of balanced states. And these balanced states have the same qualitative properties as a balanced state that you have with linear transmission. So you don't have averaging in time. You don't have, you have a residual order one fluctuation and average input when you do it in time. And you have order one fluctuation in space. OK? You mean if you change the background? I have the bifurcation diagram, but in some slides. But you get you, no. It will change the size. It will. It can change. Yes. The activity will be higher, but yeah. Yeah. Now you are talking about stronger Q input, or you are talking about strong? Ah, yeah. So you get more activity in the. It will relax. Yeah. No, I mean you have several fixed points. Well, the fixed points, the persistent is when you take out the Q, right? Except, I mean, it's not exactly, okay. I will say something. 1 second. Yeah. This is especially for you. It's I want to say something about that. I want just also to say that we have some diversity in the dynamics. Also, you see, for instance, in this case, so we have four different neurons. Actually, I don't remember. These are four different neurons when the Q was presented as the preferred direction of that neuron. Okay. So in this case, you have this overshoot and then something stable. Here there is no overshoot or ramp. In this case, it's more or less, I mean, the response during the Q is not very phasic. And this is the same neuron with Q at different directions around the preferred. And you see that you have also some difference in the dynamics. Okay. Okay. Here is the answer. But how, look at me in the scale here. Okay? So you have, strictly speaking, in this network there is no, there is not a continuum set of attractors, obviously. It's broken by the heterogeneities. Okay? Still, the drift, and you have a small number of attractors. Typically it will be 2, 3, 4. It depends on the width of the population bump. Okay? Now, it turns out that the drift is slow. And this here comes in the another property that of this short-term plasticity that I neglected. Until now, I don't want to talk about it. Now it's the dynamics of the short-term plasticity of the facilitation, and this relates to another work that we did recently with Misha Sodix and with Vladimir Itzkov, where we were interested in how short-term plasticity can reduce, slow down the drift of a bump when you have a random component in the connectivity. So what we were able to do was to treat this problem not in the balanced state, but in the standard ring model. And what we showed, we found that indeed with short-term plasticity, with facilitation, so you can substantially slow down the drift of the bump. And so I should have brought. What here some as a result of simulations that we did also in integrated and fire network, outside of the balance regime, it's very substantial. I mean, if you don't, I mean, you can reduce by a factor of 10 to 50. So of course, it's the time constant. The fact that you have the slow time constant is one of the main factors of this. 1/tau. Yeah. No, we have the whole calculation for that. Huh? Yeah. Now I want to explain. Qualitatively, why it is like this. I mean, this is very reasonable. So what is happening is that since the bump is, so in the region where the bump is active, you have the bump, so you have, you facilitated the interaction of facilitation. Now this time constant of the facilitation is slow. So you are reinforcing the connectivity there. And in order to, the bump will be stabilized by this, will be kept there. So you are, it's a way to regulate for these heterogeneities, which are local, by sorry? So, of course, the velocity will depend on the number of neurons that you have in the bump. Yeah. And this is what is shown here. It depends on the number of neurons that you have and also on the connectivity. So when you increase, this is as a function of log n for two different values of the connectivity. So the log of the velocity, we measure the velocity. I mean, we have to average over many realizations to do it in a proper way. But essentially what you find that it will decay when n increases, so it's reduced. So, I mean, all this to say two things. One thing, I mean, and in a way, this is a message of the... Yeah, this is the message of this work. So we, because of the short-term plasticity, first of all, we don't need short-term plasticity per se in order to get the multistability of balanced states. What we need is non-linearity of the interactions. And in the E2E, and with this appropriate shape. So you can imagine this other source of non-linearities and short-term plasticity. It can be dendritic, it can be, I don't know, many things that we can be interesting to think. Other substrates. Now, short-term plasticity has an advantage, which is that it slows down also the bump. If you have non-linearity, which is instantaneous, I mean, which is a So then you will have the balance regime. You have the problem of the heterogeneities, which are going to induce a drift. So I think that short-term plasticity here is a good, very good solution in a way that it solves two problems. I mean, it allows us to explain this high variability, and also it solves the problem of the drift in the balance in the balanced state. What we have here. Yeah, so this is, okay, so now there is, of course, the question, which is now, what about in reality the facilitation in the E2E synapses in prefrontal cortex? So there is at least one paper talking about that. It's the Yun Wang paper and collaborator paper in Nature Neuroscience 3 or 4 years ago, where they showed that there is a population of pyramidal cells in dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, which are making synapses and are connected between them with synapses displaying short-term plasticity and facilitating short-term plasticity. So this is something which, in a way, is maybe specific to the prefrontal cortex, less observed, I think, in other areas of the cortex. But in somatosensory, it's not like this. This is a friend of my son who thinks that... I don't know why. some perspective. What we'd like to do is what we did in part until now, really develop analytical calculation and to do the mean field theory of this balance, nonlinear balanced state analytically. So we're doing this with Gianluigi Mongillo and with Carl. We did already the case of bistability. Now we would be very interesting to do also the understand better the conditions for the selectivity also. Investigators a combination of synaptic nonlinearities. I already mentioned the type of nonlinearities. We can think of many other ways to do this in short-term plasticity by itself. Other architecture. Other type of working memory tasks, because this was the oculomotor delay task. Now there are many other situations can be for discrete memory also. And then I'm coming back to your question. What about the single cell scenario? So that's the point. What I wanted to say here is the following, is that, so there is a debate, single cell versus network. So now the question of the question is whether when and people they see neurons which can be bistable under some conditions. So Alonso et al. So there it was there was some manipulation. There is now I heard about this this work by Strawbridge, with whom I was sharing the office here. So where they see kind of bistability in hippocampus without any specific putting anything in the drug in the bus. But so there's a debate now. Before the debate on whether it is due to the drug or not due to the drug or specific conditions, I mean, can we explain the variability in this context? And I'm not sure. I think that we cannot.
I think you're right.
But. Yeah.
So we just constructed this simple sequence
vessel. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And the transfer function is just bistable. So then we ask ourselves, if I now construct a big model of this bistable neurons, what happens? And we see something, it has its properties, it has robustness against its fragments and the anchoring. But of course, because it's not coming from the balance, but it's coming from the system.
Now I will put I will say in French a bémol. I don't know how to say this in English. I will make my statement a bit less strong, and I will say the following: that it can be that possibility would be that actually the single cell is becoming bistable in the network. That if you take it out of the network, it is monostable. But in the network, it can be bistable. So bistability would come from a single cell in a way. And then it will be a network effect combined with some intrinsic properties. And that then it's possible to solve the problem and to keep the, to have the high variability. And that, I mean, in some way, maybe when they manipulate the conditions of bus and getting this bistability of single cell. So it can be that what they are doing is effectively mimicking some network effect, which we didn't. I will not rule out completely the single cell scenario. I would say that it has to be. Yeah. I mean, they inject only in one neuron.
No, I know, but is there a network effect or not? I mean, the culture. I would have to go back.
No, what I'm saying a network effect in vivo. A network effect in vivo. Yeah. Which we switch off the single neuron from. So then maybe, I mean, it can be different there. So I would be with. I don't want to totally say it's. Okay. Yeah, I mean, frankly, I don't know. I mean, we did not look at this, but it's reasonable. What you say is reasonable, that it will not, I mean, it's not a linear integrator. Yeah.